oftentimes it's not an intentional restriction. It's just this inadvertent underfueling where an athlete increases their intensity of those miles and they don't match their energy intake to really meet those needs.
This is Running for Real, the podcast for runners who know that for every runner's high, there are just as many lows. All those just missed PRs, easy runs that feel hard, injury blues, and more. Each week, we'll talk to running, health, and wellness experts about their highs, lows, and best advice to build our confidence. Running for Real is about being honest, being brave, and most of all, not feeling alone. And now here's our host, who always wanted to go on an English TV show called Funhouse, Tina Muir.
Hello, my friends, and welcome to episode 70 of the Running for Real podcast. Thank you so much for joining me today. I really appreciate you tuning in. So last week we had Matt Lano on the show, who is a 212 marathoner, a 101.47 half marathoner, which is, by the way, the 17th fastest American of all time, and a 28-minute 10K. So Matt is humble, kind, and I'm sure you loved his story as much as I did. You know, he's very brave, and I just love the way that he lives his life. It's exciting also to hear about his future now he has parted ways with Northern Arizona Elite, and I hope you enjoyed that episode. Today I have a guest who I knew from the first time I heard her name or heard about her. I knew I wanted her on the show. Dr. Emily Krause is a sports medicine physician at Stanford University of all places, so you know off the bat she has to be good at what she does. We talk a lot about injuries, especially in the hip and pelvic area, which is, I think, often neglected. You know, whenever we have injury interviews, they tend to be about, you know, lower leg or knees and just the common areas, but that hip and pelvic area, I'm sure most of you know by now, is kind of the key here. So you might be surprised at what a lot of the prevention comes down to in this episode. I definitely was. But she's not just a good doctor, she's a very good runner too, so you won't believe how fast her PR in the marathon is. So before we meet our sponsors, Body Health and Aptive, I just wanted to start my pledge to ask you if you could give me an early 30th birthday present. I turn 30 very soon, and I'd really appreciate if you could leave me a rating and review on iTunes, if you haven't already, of course. That helps new listeners find this podcast, and the more of you that there are listening, the more big guests that you want to hear from I can get, because that's less likely that they are going to ignore my emails or ignore my outreach if they know that there's more of you listening. So thank you so much in advance if you do that. Your birthday present is much appreciated. All right, let's meet Hoka and Aptive, and then we will get to the episode. Thank you to Hoka One One for sponsoring this episode of Running for Real. Hoka One One is a running shoe unlike any other. A little different, right? And maybe you're unsure if you'll like them. Well, once you run in their newest release, the Clifton 5, you will see what all the buzz is about. It has marshmallow soft cushion and marshmallow lightweight to keep you comfortable throughout the day. This episode of the Running for Real podcast is brought to you by Aptive. Aptive provides audio-based workouts created by certified personal trainers available through a mobile app. New members get 30% off an annual membership by visiting aptive.com/running for real. That's aptive.com/running for real. That's the number for running for real. Emily, thank you so much for joining me on the Running for Real podcast. I am really excited for everyone to learn from you. I had the pleasure of talking to you a few weeks ago, and I'm excited for everyone else to learn. So thank you so much for giving me some time and letting us learn from you today.
Of course, Tina. I'm really happy to be here. It's an honor.
Yeah. Oh, well, thank you. It's an honor to have you on here. And so you work as the Stanford, I'm going to get you to explain this, LPCH sports medicine physician, which is quite a mouthful. And I didn't even pronounce four of the words, apparently. So tell us what exactly it is you do at, I'm sure the one word people picked out was, or two words, Stanford and physician. So tell us the rest.
Yeah, I'd be happy to explain. So LPCH stands for Lucile Packard Children's Hospital. So I work within the Department of Children's Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. However, my training was in a field called physical medicine and rehabilitation, or it's also called physiatry. Should not be confused with podiatry. I'm not a foot doctor, nor am I a psychiatrist. So I don't deal with specifically mental health, although there is some mental health overlap in a lot of sports related injuries.
And what about physiotherapy? Because you're kind of
similar
as well.
It does sound similar. So part of my training was in physical medicine. So a lot of the emphasis was working on the functional status of a patient. And we had the good fortune of working very closely with physical therapists and occupational therapists as part of our training and practice. And so we usually take a multidisciplinary team approach to our care of our athletes.
Good. Cool. Well, thank you so much for explaining. And as you mentioned about training, when you said training, my mind went somewhere else, because something that you guys might not know, which is incredibly impressive, most people are able to do, you know, they're able to be this real stud in their field, be, you know, great at what they do in their career. But Emily is also a 2:53 marathoner, which you ran I think it must have been a week before we spoke, which is amazing that you went like, hey, guess what I did? Because, like, you know, you're so nice and, you know, calm and telling me or answering my questions. But, you know, that's so impressive. And, you know, just a few months ago. And the question that I'm sure many listeners are wondering, how the heck did you find time to train when you've got, you know, you've got so many things that you're working on? You are, you know, a really important job here. How did you manage to fit it all in?
Oh, thank you, Tina. Yeah, it was really exciting. The race was Mountains to Beach, which was the end of May, and it was a PR, 2:53 PR for me. But the running and my practice of sports medicine, there's this lovely overlap, and a lot of my passions kind of intertwine between the two. Running is something that keeps me sane. I often go on runs with friends who then I can talk shop with about running related injuries, or we can just completely escape the kind of day-to-day work life.
So you don't actually mind, like, you mean people might say to you, hey, this is bothering me. You don't mind doing that while you're running?
No. I kind of call it like my version of a fireside chat. We go for a run. We talk about the injury. And sometimes it's nice because it's a more informal way for them to talk about something that's really bothering them and kind of probably occupies a lot of their time and thoughts. And if I can do anything to help them navigate this crazy system of injury and recovery and kind of get to the right person, I would be happy to do that. And it's really rewarding for me.
Cool. So you know, do you fit it in like in lunchtimes and mornings, or is there kind of
all of the above?
Yeah, whenever you can, really.
Yeah, I have some good girlfriends that we will get up early and do harder workouts, which is a huge motivation to me. I don't know how I would get in those workouts otherwise. Every now and then I will have an opening midday in clinic. And so I'll sneak out for a run and race back and clean up and get back into clinic. But I do try to respect that recovery is really important and having balance. And I make sure and optimize my sleep and nutrition, which I hope we get into a little bit today. And it's all kind of part of the package.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on, you know, we do have some runner physicians, some runners who understand and kind of, you know, might run a little bit, but someone who's running 2:53, like you're training pretty seriously there. You're doing really well, and the workouts must be going well. Everything must be going well. So how does the advice that you give to others kind of change for yourself? Because do you ever find yourself, you know, especially when you are maybe when you were trying to break 3 hours, did you fall into the trap of, oh, I want it so bad, I might just push the boundary just a little bit further? Did you have to hold yourself back and remind yourself of what you teach others? Like, how did that kind of go about?
You know, I completely, Tina. So before, a couple of years ago, I didn't have a coach. Mm-hmm. And so I was running on my own, and I'd often catch myself running 7 days a week, kind of easy, not really having the variation and with recovery runs and off days and more high intensity days. Mm-hmm. But I soon realized that I needed a coach and that I was kind of running in a rut all the time and not really kind of taking my training to the next level. And I realized that I had been overtraining during that time. And having a coach, I respected that day off, and I actually learned to enjoy it and really appreciate that time for my muscles and body to truly recover and repair themselves. But yes, I will also find myself wanting to push the limit and push the boundaries. And being a sports medicine physician can sometimes be a double-edged sword, because I sometimes try and self-diagnose myself or I try and minimize my symptoms. But then I relate myself. I consider the advice that I give to my patients, and I soon realize that may mean another couple of days off, or maybe I need to readjust my schedule. And so I've had a very supportive coach who has been willing to work with me on adjusting the training to kind of fit. Maybe I have a conference that week. Maybe we'll just push that long run to the next weekend or when I get back. And so I've learned to not be rigid with my training, and that being more flexible has made it actually more fun. And I've actually had much more improvements in just performance.
Yeah.
As well.
I mean, clearly by running what you did, it didn't just run under three, you smashed under three. So really cool. But did you, you mentioned about overtraining, that you had that. Did you have any bigger injuries that kind of came up? Or if you didn't, either scenario, like, was there any part of you that was a little bit kind of embarrassed to say something, to be like, oh, I'm supposed to be the expert, why did this, I can't believe I like fell for the same mistakes that everyone else does. So did any part of you struggle with that at any point?
Yes, definitely. About 2 years ago, I had run the Boston Marathon for the second time. It was definitely a really rewarding experience. I'd run a 2:57 that year. And afterwards, I felt so good that I didn't take into account how my body really needed that time to recover and repair from such a hard effort, especially running a road marathon. Really just respecting that time to let your body heal. And that way you can kind of bounce back and really come back strong. I took maybe a week of dedicated time off, and then got back into some casual running and ramped back up to just a little bit more of high intensity running. And throughout the summer, really battled with some overtraining symptoms and had to back off significantly as far as volume, intensity. And I had a heart rate cap throughout the summer. And after that, I was, like you had mentioned, I was a little ashamed of my own kind of ignorance of where I was and my own training. I kind of thought I was invincible and could beat the system. And I soon realized that there really isn't a way to cheat or beat the system. And whether it's from a nutrition standpoint or just overtraining standpoint, you really need to respect that time and respect the off season.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I think that's good for other people to hear that, when they do go to see someone, an expert about something that's going on, that person shouldn't be judging you, because chances are if they're a runner themselves, they've made some mistakes along the way too. And it just kind of makes you more real, feeling like, the ones of us that get injured are not like stupid people who just make stupid mistakes, because everyone makes mistakes, even the experts. So that's good for them to hear. Now, on that note, you and I first connected because of our mutual friend, Mario Frioli. And it was about when I was having some hip glute pain, trying to come back after I had the baby. And many of my listeners know about this. And I thought we would kind of talk about this for a few minutes and then go into more general stuff. So if you haven't just had a baby, bear with us for a minute, but you still will probably find this interesting. So for women postpartum, what should they know about, coming back to running after having a baby, when it comes to, their hips, pelvis, back, all of that kind of area? It's easy to think, well, that I had my baby, for me, I had my baby 4 months ago. Like, why is this still bothering me? Bailey should be long out of my system by now. So what would you like to say to women who are going through that right now?
Great question, Tina. And so full disclosure, I have never been pregnant, I'm gone through that experience, but I have interacted and heard a lot of stories from mothers and both elite runners, recreational runners who have had babies and have had struggled, especially during those early stages of getting back and that return to running kind of postpartum. And one of the challenges is, you know, during that time of holding that life in your body, I mean, your body is going through a lot of changes, weight gain, appropriate weight gain. Our ligaments are more lax or kind of especially around the pelvis area to allow for that pregnancy to happen and or the delivery to happen. And the time after that, as your body is returning to its kind of normal state, it's often not just this natural snap of a finger and the ligaments are back and everything's in the right position and exactly where you started at from a running standpoint. And trying to rush that and get back to that point too quickly can be pretty harmful. For example, when we talk about kind of postpartum breastfeeding and the kind of that transient low bone density that takes place during that time, there is that risk of if you increase your volume too quickly or that impact activity too quickly, you may kind of run that risk of a stress reaction or stress fracture. When we talk about the pelvis, there are a lot of changes that happen on those with those muscles, and specifically after the delivery, those muscles, they maybe have less tone and strength than they had prior to that pregnancy. And the pelvis is a very intricate bone with some very important ligaments, and sometimes those ligaments, as they return to the kind of their normal structure when they're less lax, they may be a little out of balance, and sometimes they call it pelvic obliquity. And with that, oftentimes requires some additional type of strengthening to prepare your body to get back back to its running or whatever the sport may be. So there's a lot of there's a lack of good research on return to sport and return to running postpartum. So it's a challenge. I've been lucky. I picked some brains of some experts in the field, both out of University of Florida, Christine Morgan, Meryl Alipatu, and both of them I would consider really experts in the field and have a wealth of knowledge on what it takes to get an athlete kind of back to that normal prior level. And a lot of it is strength-based. So both kind of pelvic floor strengthening, which isn't in a lot of magazines, strength and conditioning magazines is not in the headline, how to strengthen your pelvic floor.
Hopefully one day.
Yes, hopefully. I mean, that's really, I think what our goal is, even with this conversation, is to kind of take away that stigma of talking about pelvic pain and that return. And it's not always an easy linear return. You may have a linear for a couple of weeks, and then you may have to plateau and let your body adjust to that, to those changes, and then take a small increase again. And I think being patient with the system and also respecting that timeline, but also understanding that there's a good chance that an athlete will return to some degree of a competitive, or at least that sense of enjoyment or that feeling of enjoyment that they get from their their sport or from running.
Yeah.
And does that answer your question, Tina?
Yeah, no, it definitely did. And just, you know, you mentioned the recovery time or the period that it takes to get your body back to kind of, I don't want to say where it was, but where things kind of back in place, how they should be. How long does that take? Like how much grace should a woman give themselves after having a baby?
So I think it's very dependent on the athlete and the patients, or on the athlete and also what kind of pregnancy they had. If it was vaginal versus a C-section. A C-section is a surgery. And so they need to understand that they need to factor in that post-surgical return. There is some research on I would say a small subset of elite athletes that it could be, you know, 4-6 months before that progression begins. But it could be even longer before that kind of elite and that higher performing status can really take place. And we kind of talk about that nutrition component too, because especially if an athlete's breastfeeding, you want to make sure that that energy balance is maintained so that calories in match that energy out, and that the kind of greed of getting back to that sport too quickly doesn't take over to try to get back to a pre-race weight that's kind of unrealistic for the bodily functions that are necessary to kind of keep the runner healthy, but also keep the baby healthy too.
Okay. And we're going to talk about eating and nutrition in just a second. Just one more thing though. Before we move on, you know, we talk, actually, I'm going to ask this afterwards. This is going to tie into the another question I'll ask later.
Okay.
So going back to nutrition, you said about, you know, how important it is. Just to kind of drill this point home, if you were trying to lose weight, you know, you couldn't shift those last few pounds, you know, we're trying to cut back on calories a little bit, what are some of the implications if you do that, and if you are breastfeeding in particular, what risks are you putting yourself at by underfueling, and is it okay to even do it a little bit?
So, good question. And, I will say that there are probably other experts out there that may have, even a more scientific explanation to this, but, as far as the risks of, underfueling and kind of that energy mismatch is what I like to explain. So, specifically going into that chronic energy deficit. So a period of time where, calories in are not matching energy expenditure. The risk is, well, one, the lactation, if they are lactating, they may not produce as much breast milk for their baby. And there's also the risk of altered bone health. So there is already a risk of potential low bone density, kind of in a transient or temporary phase while breastfeeding. But if that energy mismatch happens, that could lead to an even lower level of the hormone, specifically estrogen, which then can pull more, so that kind of prevents bone building or bone formation and actually increases bone breakdown. And so that you're just kind of putting yourself up for an even greater risk of a bone stress injury, a stress reaction, or a stress fracture. And other consequences as far as just feeling, having low energy, which is not good when you're already not getting enough sleep to put yourself in a greater energy or just fatigue level, and irritability, all of these other components that we think about. And maybe this is the not right time, but I also want to give kind of a plug for this relative energy deficiency in sport, or REDS, which has, they just came out with a new consensus statement this year on an update. And the realization that low or underfueling can affect all other parts of your body and all these other physiologic processes, which are important for just normal function in daily life.
And I will put a link to that in the show notes just to... for anyone who wants to read that, because I know plenty of my listeners are interested in this topic. And on that note, for if any of you out there have kind of been like me and went through amenorrhea, you're already at a higher risk of bone issues. So, you know, you're just giving yourself one more, your body, one more reason to break down. So, you know, don't do it. Okay. So let's talk about, nutrition a bit more. You know, you were recently featured kind of helping out, or maybe, I think you were helping out with an article, by Christine Yu, a great writer who talked about, eating to prevent injuries. Mm-hmm. So does eating really make that much of a difference to preventing injuries? What is it that, you know, is affecting us that much?
Yeah. So I was so glad that Christine published that article. It was an Outside magazine, maybe a few months ago.
Yeah.
And it highlighted some research that we're doing at Stanford that's appropriately named the Healthy Runner Project. And we're looking at whether nutrition intervention decreases the incidence of stress fractures, as well as just the severity of the stress fracture too. So if it's a full-on break versus a just a stress reaction. And we're also looking at other bone health parameters. And so the goal is that a nutrition intervention that actually looks at trying to maintain that energy balance in collegiate athletes will change their overall bone health. Mm-hmm. And we're looking at DEXA bone density scans. We're getting questionnaires, looking at menstrual history in these athletes, but we're also looking at males and females. So we're getting information from the males just the same. And we're doing some interesting hormonal workup to see if we can find early signs that there could be an issue. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that you've talked in other podcasts about the female athlete triad. And
yeah, but you can feel free to explain it. I mean, I know I do have lots of new listeners, so.
Great. Yep. So quick definition, a female athlete triad, three interrelated components. One, menstrual irregularities. So that could be amenorrhea, so having no periods, or it could be oligomenorrhea, so less than 12 periods in a year. So maybe an athlete has a period every couple of months. Maybe an athlete loses their period during heavy training, which is not normal. And we're trying to educate that at all levels, especially in our high school athletes. So that's one component. Another component is low energy availability, which is that underfueling component and the nutrition component. So calories in are not matching energy out, and especially at a chronic level. So if they're doing this over weeks or over days to weeks, that chronic energy deficit can take a toll. And then the third component is suboptimal bone health, which a determinant of bone health is bone mineral density. And that's really the only standard that we have to measure bone mineral density in the clinic right now. And that's through DEXA scans. Okay. So low bone mineral density, you can't really call an athlete osteoporotic unless they have meet these certain parameters, but some degree of low bone mineral density. So we're looking at all those parameters, and then we look at an athlete and we determine their risk score and how what risk they have to develop a bone stress injury based on a female athlete triad consensus statement. That was I can also help you get that link.
Yeah,
too.
Definitely. Mm-hmm.
Yep, that was published back in 2014. We're looking at both females. We're also applying that to males too. And so we're doing the same screening, except for just eliminating the questions about their period. But we're seeing that these athletes who score higher on these risk scores have a greater risk of stress fracture. And so our main goal with these athletes that do score higher is to make sure that they have an appropriate nutrition intervention. And we have the good fortune of having a sports dietitian that can get into some of the weeds and the details of their day-to-day fueling. And oftentimes it's not an intentional restriction. It's just this inadvertent underfueling where an athlete increases their, maybe not even increases the number of miles per week, but maybe it's just the intensity of those miles.
Yeah.
And they don't match their energy intake to really meet those needs. And it could also be that the timing is off, that they're fueling all at one period of the day when they really need that fuel throughout the day or, you know, directly after that big, hard effort. So it's not just total number of calories at the end of the day, but it's how you time those calories during the day.
Okay.
And I wish I could go into much more detail about that, but usually I then hand the baton over to my sports dietitian who goes into a much more elaborate discussion and can really get into a more individual approach to each athlete, because everybody has dietary preferences and has certain things that they, certain habits, and you really want to, not everybody can be treated equally from an injury recovery, but also a nutrition intervention.
Okay. That's good to mention, because I think it is too easy to kind of see someone else. And in this social media world, it's too easy for us to see what someone else is eating and say, well, I'm eating the same as them, but you know, maybe that's not enough for you. And for them, that's enough. So yeah, I think that's important to mention. And for anyone listening, I would recommend listening to the Nancy Clark episode. That's pretty much what Emily is talking about. That's episode 26. So go back and check the one out. I will have a link in the show notes as well. But when it comes to this underfueling, is it just about kind of how many calories are going in, or does the variety of the diet kind of make a difference as well? Like having enough fats, proteins, carbs, how does that kind of play into it?
Yeah, I would say quality is really important. Best example, I had an athlete, a collegiate athlete that we were treating for female athlete triad. She unfortunately had sustained a stress fracture in her sacrum, and which is a high risk site, and is frustrating because it's an insufficiency type fracture, and I'll kind of go into detail of what an insufficiency versus a fatigue fracture is. So, insufficiency fracture would be a fracture that is a kind of a normal load to a weak bone. So you think about your kind of osteoporotic elderly female walking across the street and falls and breaks her hip. That's an insufficiency fracture. Mm-hmm. The fatigue fracture is that kind of a higher load on a healthy bone. So maybe that's ramping up mileage too quickly, or kind of like those metatarsal fractures from kind of maybe a different type of training or an increase in training. And we're seeing a lot of overlap in collegiate athletes now, where we're seeing these components of both the insufficiency and fatigue fracture. And this was one of those cases. And so there were a lot of issues with fueling and kind of hitting her mark as far as kind of caloric intake. Mm-hmm. And she had really struggled to try and get that fuel in. And one of the issues was she just always felt so full. And the dietitian, once she kind of teased out what she was eating, she realized she was only eating vegetables and salads and all these like really fibrous foods that were just making her feel really bloated. So she actually kind of increased the amount of healthy fats she had, and she actually felt overall better. Mm-hmm. And was at a healthier weight, and had return of her menses, or return of her periods. And I remember that day when she came in and told me that she had her first period in like, you know, maybe a year. And we were so excited. I think I hugged her, and those little steps and those little breakthroughs.
Oh, I get that.
And I know, I feel like when you were on Mario's podcast, you had kind of talked about kind of taking away that stigma from talking about, you know, amenorrhea or that menstrual health. And mm-hmm. I think it should be talked openly and publicly, and there shouldn't be this
whispering.
Yeah. Right. It's something that I talk about very openly with my athletes. And even with my male athletes, I talk about fueling, and I talk about, you know, that I'm not accusing them of, you know, an eating disorder, and they shouldn't have that feel of, kind of being attacked, mm-hmm. or that feeling of being attacked. But I'm really just asking if they're meeting their energy needs. And oftentimes they're so busy with everything else in their life that the idea of thinking about their nutrition is sometimes overwhelming. Mm-hmm. But, if you kind of develop these habits early, then once they're integrated into your system and into your day-to-day life, it's much easier to continue.
Yeah, definitely. Once you've made the change and kind of realized that, like for me, I realized now that I was under fueling. I wasn't intentional, but I definitely was. And, you know, so now I know to be conscious of it as I move forward, and many others the same. So you talked about the two fractures, the insufficiency and the fatigue. Are there, like, for someone listening who maybe doesn't quite realize, or maybe not willing to accept, that this underfueling is an issue, but they do keep having stress fractures, what areas, you mentioned sacrum, tend to be the areas that if it's insufficiency, if it is fuel related, that someone might get? Like you mentioned, mm-hmm. you know, metatarsal, that's, you know, more likely to be a fatigue one. But for someone listening who's thinking, well, maybe that's me, but I think I'm okay, I do eat enough, mm-hmm. but then they keep getting fractures in these areas, you're going to tell me, what signs should they watch for?
Yeah. And I think, so these high, when we use the word high risk fracture sites in research and with our presentations and kind of explaining to athletes, so high risk would be areas that could not heal or lead to delayed healing, and fracture sites that are of trabecular bone. So that's a different type of bone than cortical bone. That's a little bit more compact, like we have in our metatarsal or in some of our foot bones. So the femoral neck is another example of a trabecular bone site that is, I would consider, a high risk location that maybe should be, that really should be investigated further as far as the why. Why did this happen? The sacrum is another example. Some of the other pelvic bones, especially if a recurring pelvic stress fracture occurs, a further bone health workup would be warranted. Let's see. The navicular bone, I would say, is a more of a high-risk site because there is a risk of poor healing to that bone. So I would definitely, I wouldn't treat it like another foot bone stress fracture because if it doesn't heal, or if you don't respect that period of immobilization, that could be a chronic non-union that could kind of plague them for many for a long term.
Yeah, no, and that's basis. Good to know. And then if someone does keep getting these injuries, is nutrition the first thing, kind of the first and usual culprit, and the thing you should address first?
So if an athlete comes in with recurring stress fractures, I usually do ask, get into more details about nutrition. I ask about their periods. I get into their training. Maybe they're doing two-a-days or trying to, especially I have some high school female runners who are trying to keep up with the boys. And oftentimes it's a big ramp up in their training too quickly. Mm-hmm. So sometimes it is just a training error. And I also ask about just overall bone health questions. Are they taking are they getting enough calcium and vitamin D in their diet? And sometimes I will even ask about iron. Mm-hmm. There's some newer research that's coming out that's looking at the relationship of iron deficiency and bone health. And it's not just about, overall poor intake, because sometimes that will play a role. Just an athlete who isn't fueling across the board, they're probably not getting enough iron as well. But there's also just the effects of iron deficiency, even without anemia. So even without like a drop in hemoglobin, that could overall affect bone health. So sometimes I will get an iron level on an athlete too, just to make sure their nutrients are optimized on all accounts.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for sharing about that and clearing that up. Now, before we move on from this, well, actually, I do want to ask you a bit more about this just in a different way. But, when you and I talked on the phone, you said about pelvic and sacral stress fractures. You know, when I first spoke to you, I was a little bit worried that might be what I had after listening to our old friend, Dr. Google.
Dr. Google.
Yeah, always gets us in trouble. But you said that we also need to be careful that we don't become afraid of sacrum and pelvic fractures and kind of take it the other way. What did you mean by that?
Yeah. So I feel like as runners, especially if you've had an injury in the past, or you know someone who's had an injury in the past that's really been devastating for them or for yourself, we start to get this almost, I wouldn't call it them phantom pains, because I think they're real, but we kind of jump to that fearful conclusion that mm-hmm. whatever pain that you have is a fracture,
yeah, or which is exactly
bony related. And then you kind of perseverate and obsess over that pain. And I think that you have to strike that fine balance between understanding that when you return to a sport or an activity, you are going to have these migrating aches and pains. However, my big concern is if that pain stays and it's very focal and it stays in one place, then that should probably be investigated or looked into, or maybe take a couple of days off and see where things go. You try and get back into running after a couple of days. So, and the challenge I would say with pelvic pain is that there could be so many things actually involved. Like I was saying, the pelvic imbalances that are at play postpartum, or even just with running, and especially as you are recovering from whatever pelvic injury, whether that's a bone injury or just a tendonitis or tendinopathy, you may notice that the other tendons acting up, or now it's kind of higher up in the glute. What does that mean? And I think respecting those pains, but also not freaking out that and understanding that sometimes it could be, okay, maybe I need to get back to the fundamentals of strengthening, or maybe I need to take some time off of running for a couple of days and do some cross training days instead, just to calm some of this down. But oftentimes it doesn't require a prolonged break. Mm-hmm. And as a runner myself, I feel like I try to find this activity modification strategy as opposed to a cessation of activity strategy.
Yeah, that's good. And by that, you mean just the cross training for a few days, kind of getting away from the running and just allowing your body to just chill. And yeah, I'm very much in agreement. My husband and I always do kind of a 3-day thing. Like if something is bothering me enough to kind of make me change my running form, or more than like a 4 out of 10 pain, it's take 3 days off and let's reassess. And you know, that's really nothing in the grand scheme of things. So right. encouraging right. people to do that as well. But for those injuries, you know, those are, as we've mentioned, the most dreaded injury of all, are pelvic and sacral stress fractures. So they're not kind of like the things like a shin's tibial stress fracture in that, you know, you might have shin pain for a while and it keeps getting worse and you keep ignoring it. What warning signs might someone have, or are there any, or is this usually just something that just kind of appears and then it's too late? Are there any things people can kind of know to kind of be aware of?
Yeah, good question. So I would say with sacral and pelvic stress fractures, so oftentimes they do present with this more dull, non-specific ache or pain. But some of the I would say yellow to red flags would be that it always worsens with running, and oftentimes when it stops, it really goes away. So walk, and it may start to develop with walking. So it may start with running, and then all of a sudden you try and run through it, and you're like, oh, I can just push, but it stays, or maybe it may even minimize a little bit, but then when you stop, it actually increases in that same location. I would say that would be a concern. I will also say that oftentimes you can get referred pain from the spine, but it usually isn't in that same kind of more focal region. And oftentimes there is a tenderness, especially with the sacrum, kind of to touch in that area. Okay. It's a little bit harder pelvis, just because you may feel groin pain, or you may feel kind of this kind of more deeper discomfort somewhere, and it's sometimes difficult to actually realize or pinpoint it to the like a pubic bone, mm-hmm. or kind of the wing, or some other areas of the pelvis. So mm-hmm. I'd say, especially if the pain starts to occur with just all like weight bearing, then I would get checked out.
Okay. All right, great. And we've talked about, you know, some things to prevent, some things to kind of keep in mind and not ramping up your training too quickly. You know, nutrition, obviously a huge component. Is there anything else when it comes to bone injuries, particularly those in the hips, pelvis, and back, that you would like listeners to know before we go on to something else?
Yeah. So I think there is sometimes a biomechanical component. So when I say biomechanical, I mean, maybe there are some running patterns, with the gait that could be predisposing to, excessive load or asymmetric load. So pelvic drop, for example, if an athlete is really, really hippy, you may notice that their pelvis drops on both sides, or maybe their knees collapse into, and you kind of lose what I call the window of, kind of that nice window between the knees. You may be worried about just their overall glute strength, mm-hmm. and those muscles aren't supporting the bones. I would say, I don't think there's a study out there that shows a relationship between glute strength and stress fracture. But I think if you continue to run on faulty mechanics, it could lead to just overall kind of pelvic and glute pain. Okay. Getting down to the strength-based fundamentals is probably my other take-home message on just prevention.
Okay, great. All right. Well, thank you so much for clearing that up. I hope to the listeners that was helpful, kind of talking about that thing. that in detail, because that's something that I've never brought up in the podcast, but it is something that does happen. You know, we are seeing it more and more, and something to be aware of. And there's one other thing I wanted to ask you about, which is something that you're passionate about, and I know I'm passionate about, has been a bit in the media lately. So I want to be careful with how we get on this discussion, because, you know, this is a very sensitive topic. But high school burnout, you know, Steve, my husband, and I are very passionate about it. In fact, he did his master's like thesis kind of thing on that exact thing in Kentucky. And, you know, he did find that most of the kids who were studs in their freshman year didn't make it to the senior year. So for parents listening who say the kids are doing well, that they say they're enjoying running, and maybe they are, but what would be your message based on what you've learned, what you've read about, you know, kids, let's say from age 8 to 18 on how they should treat their running?
Tina, I'm glad you brought this up. As I, in my practice, I get to see adolescent and high school athletes, and I am in shock at how many athletes are really specializing into one sport at such a young age. I think burnout is a huge risk, especially. So I live in Silicon Valley, and there's just a lot of pressure to, you know, excel at that one sport, and really sometimes it's pushed by the athlete or kind of fueled by the athlete. Sometimes it's the pressure from the coach, sometimes parents, or sometimes it's just this combination of all of the above. I would say runners, cyclists, swimmers that are training all year round for their one sport.
You mean the kids version?
Yes. Yeah, the kids version. Yes. which is even crazier. These kids are training all year round. And I even have cyclists that are training 12 months out of the year for their sport. And so the risk of burnout is incredibly high. And I really try and encourage deliberate play as opposed to deliberate practice. And there's a lot of, there's some good articles that are coming out on sport specialization and avoiding burnout in the young athlete. And I'd be happy to share some of those.
Yeah,
some
I would
of
love to put
you.
Those in there. Yeah.
But so that's one part. Trying to play multiple sports and finding the sports that they love is also really important. So maybe they have a favorite, but that doesn't mean they have to play that favorite sport all year round. And really, I emphasize the importance of an off season and mixing up the sports to ideally avoid some of that overuse and repetitive motion that they may get. So, for example, for a tennis player, I wouldn't tell that tennis player to go play squash or something else, that another racket sport. Mm-hmm. I'd say maybe go maybe swim, maybe go play soccer, some other kind of impact or organized sports that will oftentimes make them a better athlete in their other sport, because it's testing other skills, other coordination. And again, like I said, you avoid that burnout component. Mm-hmm. And I would say there's a kind of a number of hours per week that's really ideal for organized sports. And usually it's not exceeding an athlete's age. So say they're 13 years old, they shouldn't exceed 13 hours. I mean, that's a lot, but 13 hours of organized sport of any kind per week. Okay. But even younger, like 7, 8, or 9 years old. So that's another little take home point. And you'll find out, especially with gymnasts and some of these dancers, they're practicing 2 or 3 hours a day. Yeah. And that makes me a little nervous.
Yeah, so I was going to say,
planting that seed early with these parents that, that their kids, they'll still be great athletes, but, you want them to be lifelong athletes and not drop out at their in 10th grade because they're just over that sport.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay. So let's go into this, because this is something I really, really care about. And someone listening who's thinking either they themselves or their kids, you know, you've just said to kind of rotate the sports, but someone's saying either their child's saying this or they're thinking it, they're really good. You know, they're top of their class. They're running so well. They, you know, you see this, I can't even count the amount of people that have come up to me here and said, I know this kid that can run a 6 minute mile at age 10. Imagine what they're going to be doing at age 16. And I just like, I don't want to know, like, please don't tell me. I don't want to hear this. But for someone who's thinking this scene, if I do other sports, I'm taking, you know, that's time away from running that they could be getting better. Or even the kid is like, I don't want to do this other sport. I want to run. Or what, you know, what can you say back to that?
Yeah. Sometimes we forget that these athletes, these kids, they're still developing and growing. So they have growth plates that are continuing to grow. They have tendons that are attached to those growth plates. And if you don't allow those growth plates and that body to grow naturally, without, the excessive training of a specific sport, especially the same sport all year round, you do run the risk of early overuse injury. Also run the risk of them just not excelling at that sport as you would expect. So it's not this linear or tangential curve that is going to mean that their level now is going to lead to their the development and evolution of their mm-hmm. sport later. So there's a lot of other factors at play in a growing kid that sometimes we forget about. So they're not a 22-year-old who's starting to kind of really hone in on their sports and grow from that. So I think with growing bones, growing muscles, you need to subject them to all different sports to allow them to grow kind of naturally in balance mm-hmm. and in a balanced way. And that also means taking some time off and just enjoying sports and having fun, like playing in the pickup games.
Even if that kind of means you say to them, like, look, let's take a break away from all sports. If you don't want to play tennis or if you don't want to swim, let's just take some time off, you know, even make it during the summer where it's vacation time. Having that time away, if they don't want to do something else, just something yes. to help them. Okay. And then I'm assuming with the girls in this situation, you're also putting them at risk of never, you know, having primary amenorrhea, never mm-hmm. getting a period. And then both boys and girls, the risk of these bone injuries we've been talking about today, because things haven't quite finished growing as they should. And you've already overused them, as you said. Am I correct in saying that?
Absolutely. I did my training at Stanford and also did my fellowship training at Stanford. And I remember having college athletes who came to me and they hadn't had their first period. There was a college athlete that hadn't had her first period yet. And I remember thinking back, like, my gosh, if only it could have been there during those high school years when they were excelling at their sport, when she was excelling at her sport. But there was this missing component, really important hormonal component, that the consequences now are much greater than they were back then. And so I do have some athletes that are kind of in that critical time frame right now, and there is some kind of high volume or higher intensity activity. And so it's much easier to tell them to, you know, back off and, mm-hmm. It doesn't mean do nothing, but it does mean, you know, mixing it up. And like you said, summertime is a great time to relax and kind of take somewhat of an off season before yeah. the organized sports and that high school ramps up again.
Mm-hmm. And what age would you say this we kind of are treating this to? Is it 18 or a little bit earlier?
Earlier, I would say. So we call amenorrhea starting from kind of 15 on. So if they haven't had their period by, if a female hasn't had her period by 15, I start to kind of question if they're an athlete, kind of what their diet's like and what their training's like.
Okay. That I'm glad you said that, but I was actually referring to kind of treating them, you know, making them play and making them kind of take it easier. Is age 18 the kind of green light you can kind of start to wrap
right. up? And I'm not saying that like they can't go and go hard in their sport, but I am saying there's a lot of research that shows that a lot of our NCAA Division I athletes, they were three sport athletes in high school. Good. And they need to remember that it is good to experiment with other sports. And
okay. Cool. Thank you so much. All right. We're just going to take a moment to thank our sponsors and we'll be back with the Running for All 4. This podcast is sponsored by Hoka One One. Have you thought about getting yourself a pair of Hoka One One shoes yet? Come on, you're tempted, aren't you? I was wondering what all the fuss was about, and now I get it. I am enjoying them so much that the Clifton 5 have become my new favourite shoe, with their marshmallow soft cushion and marshmallow lightweight that will keep you comfortable throughout the day. Many of the best professional runners out there right now are wearing them for everything from training to workouts. I even think you could race in them. They are that comfortable and light, and if they're good enough for the best out there, they're definitely good enough for us. It is the sweetest cushion. Fine-tuned with new overlays and a sleek design, you can get yours today by visiting hokaoneone.com/runningforreal. That's spelled hokaoneone.com/runningforreal with the number 4. And you can use coupon code runningforreal, again with the number 4, for free expedited shipping to become part of the family. It's time to fly. This episode of the Running For Real podcast is brought to you by Aptiv. Aptiv provides audio-based workouts created by certified personal trainers available through a mobile app. What does that mean you get? Well, access to expert trainers, a flexible audio workout format so you can work out the way you like, and I've told you over and over again how important it is to listen to your body. The Aptiv trainers have a wide array of personalities so you can find the personal training style that motivates you. You know I love the gentle, be kind to yourself approach, but maybe that doesn't work for you. What is even cooler is that Aptiv's in-house music production team creates music playlists that are perfectly timed to the intensity and pace of your training. When you need a boost, the music keeps you going. When you need to back off, the music dials back with you. Aptiv also has a 5K, 10K, half and full marathon training program. And for future mamas out there, there's a full maternity program broken down by trimester so you can work out and build strength for a healthy pregnancy. Pretty cool, huh? Subscriptions start at $14.99 billed monthly or $99.99 for an annual membership. But for a limited time, new members get 30% off an annual membership by visiting aptiv.com/runningforreal. That's aptiv.com/runningforreal with the number 4. All right, Emily, just 4 more questions for you, starting with a unique nutrition tip or something you use in your training.
So this, I wouldn't say this is a nutrition tip, but one thing that I implemented a few years ago was Burger Sunday, or trying to eat a burger a week. My first year of residency, I was training for a marathon, and which I don't think was probably a good idea looking back. I mean, hindsight, it's always 2020, right? And I was feeling really fatigued. It was in the springtime, and I was going up a flight of stairs rounding, and I had to almost stop mid-flight and catch my breath. And it dawned on me that, you know, I think I'm anemic. I think I had my hemoglobin's low. So I got tested, and my hemoglobin was at a level that I potentially could have gotten a blood transfusion. Wow. And I realized over the past year of residency that I hadn't had unintentionally eliminated red meat from my diet. Mm-hmm. And at that point, I stopped training for the race. It just wasn't healthy and was not safe to continue to train. And I implemented this burger a week where I would go around and find the best burger at a restaurant. And I identified it was actually quite fun. I found some of my favorite burger places. And at that point I was back in Nebraska. So you can imagine the red meat selection was much better than other places. So I would say that's kind of, it might even be going into your question number 2, as far as just a kind of a real life moment that I had was respecting my own nutrition and knowing, and I was really disappointed that I had this exciting idea of running a marathon during my intern year and that I could do it all. And I realized that I wasn't superhuman and I needed to take care of myself. Yeah. And that lesson I carry on even now.
Definitely a running for real moment there. And you are my kind of girl with having a burger a week. I love that. Although you have to tell us now, in Nebraska and then maybe in around the Bay Area, where are the best burgers?
You know, I'll say that I live in Woodside, and there is this pub burger. I call it like my fancy burger. So it's the expensive burger, and it's at the Village Pub, and it has this really awesome, almost like toasted bun. Mm. That, yeah, it's good. So
okay, cool. And then in Nebraska?
It's close to my, yes, I do remember. There was this French brasserie called Dario's, and it was about two blocks away from where I lived at that time, in this town called, kind of smaller community called Dundee. And I loved the people there, and they had a great burger.
Okay. Well, if anyone lives in Nebraska near Dundee, go try that and let us know what you think. Okay. Emily, what about a high moment for you?
You know, I would say my high moments are so often, and it's usually running with, running with a good mate, a good friend. Mm-hmm. I have some great running buddies, and oftentimes once we hit the road and we just get to talking, and the runner's high, I feel like, is exaggerated from mm-hmm. those moments. And I've had some great running memories with Mario, my running friend Shal, my friend Elle. I feel like I finished the run, and I feel like we just started. It goes by quickly, and sometimes I'm getting my butt whooped by their pacing. But I would say those are my highs.
Great, that's so cool, and I hope one day I can join you on one of those runs. Okay, and finally, what do you tell yourself when you're on the start line of a race?
Oh man, I forgot about this one. I get pretty amped up, and I get really excited at the start line. And so at that point I say, you know, you're ready for this, put a smile on your face. I try and, smile to people around me and do my best to have fun. And, you know, having fun and running a marathon sometimes doesn't always go hand in hand, but I try and implement that each time at the line.
Good. Yeah. Well, it obviously works, cause you're doing awesome in your races. Okay. Emily, where can people find out more about you if they want to learn from you in the future? And again, to listeners, I will put links in the show notes, but where can they find you?
Yeah. So I have a clinic practice. I'm primarily located out of Sunnyvale at our Stanford Children's clinic here, but it's awesome. We have a motion lab, and I've got a great team, and happy to see all ages, not just kids. So that would probably be the best as far as clinical questions, and could also provide my email to you, Tina, to people who have questions in regards to some specifics. As like I said earlier, it's really hard sometimes to navigate the injury and the treatment and the recovery process, and whatever I can do to help with that, I'd be happy to.
Oh, that's nice of you. Thank you. And you are also on Twitter.
I will
put links to that. I don't know about other social channels, but I know you're definitely on there. So, I will put links to that. And, Emily, thank you so much. This has been really interesting and fun to learn from you. And, I am sure the listeners have loved it too. Thanks so much.
Good. Thank you so much, Tina. I had actually a lot of fun.
That's good. I just love Emily, and I hope you did too. Did you ever think nutrition would come into this that much? You know, we're told it's only food, but that's a lot of pressure to get it right. But I think more than anything, it shows that it really is always better to overfuel than underfuel. And I don't know about you, but I would rather not put myself at risk of injury and actually be able to avoid injuries than I would to look skinnier and have all this hip and pelvic stuff come up. So even though it can be stressful, again, I recommend you go listen to that Nancy Clark episode to really understand what is meant by eating well and fueling your body correctly. That doesn't mean cutting out all cakes and sweets and everything that you enjoy, because it's going to help your running. You're really actually doing yourself more harm if you are going too far overboard with the healthy eating. You can find a link to everything we talked about today in the show notes at tinamuir.com/episode70. And remember, if you could leave me a review on iTunes and share this podcast with your running community, especially if you really enjoy these episodes, you are giving me the best birthday gift I could ask for, the opportunity to continue doing these interviews. So thank you so much in advance for sharing and for your reviews and ratings. So next week I have Lindsay Hine of the I'll Have Another podcast. Now, initially, this might seem like a mummy-focused episode for Girl Chat. And yes, there is some advice for running through pregnancy and how she handles four boys, or I guess three boys and one on the way. But actually, Lindsay and I also talk about how you can start your own podcast and how you can build your followers on social media. So if you're interested in that, check out next week's episode. And until then, I hope you have a great week.
Thanks for listening to the Running For Real podcast. Be sure to check out TinaMuir.com for show notes and even more helpful running information.